Chapter 2. The Ethical Foundations of Metta. He should be able, upright, perfectly upright, of noble speech, gentle and humble. The Buddha's conditional statement that if you want this, you will need to do that, is more than an invitation, it is also a challenge. How ready are we to follow the path of peace? In the opening lines of the sutta, we are introduced to the level that our ordinary human development needs to have reached if we are to embark on the path of the higher evolution, as I call it. That is to say, the path of conscious self-development by which we can realize our full spiritual potential. Leaving aside the spiritual qualities needed for this, do we have even the basic human qualities that such an undertaking calls for? At this stage, before attempting to develop the ideal response to others that we call metta, we need to clarify how we relate to others at a basic level. Perhaps by becoming more straightforwardly ethical. Until we have done this, our ideas about metta will bear little or no relation to our ability to bring it into being in our everyday experience. Having told us what the one skilled in his good is really aiming for, the sutta's first verse therefore goes on to tell us how such a person should act. Not specifically, but in general. Capable. The sutta is not looking for signs of incipient piety. It is not saying that you need to be a sensitive soul or a spiritual person. It is simply saying that you need to be capable. It is worth noting that the first quality mentioned is one that most people would never think of associating with the spiritual life at all. Sakko, the word translated here as able, means just that, able to do, vigorous and adept. It suggests that the Buddhist approach to the spiritual life is quite practical and matter of fact. The sutta is not looking for signs of incipient piety. It is not saying that you need to be a sensitive soul or a spiritual person. It is simply saying that you need to be capable. An example from the Pali Canon shows us that some of the Buddha's very earliest disciples were anything but pious, at least to begin with. These young men were what one might today call playboys, looking for a good time and experiencing a measure of frustration and disillusionment in the process. They came from wealthy merchant families and, so the story goes, they were out picnicking one day in the countryside. They had all brought their wives along with them, all except one young man who had no wife, but who had brought along a courtesan. This young woman then rather spoiled the outing for everyone by disappearing with some ornaments, and when the Buddha came across them, they were busy searching for her. Having set out to enjoy themselves, it all turned rather sour, and the Buddha seized this moment of disillusionment to suggest to the young men that there was a more reliable source of enjoyment to be found in the Dharma. "Why waste your time searching for this woman?" asked the Buddha, "when it could be put to better use searching for yourself." Eventually, inspired by the Buddha's teachings, these playboys became what we would nowadays call monks. The episode has much that is worthy of reflection, but the point to be noted in this context is that these men were not obvious candidates for the spiritual life. They were not the types to be especially interested in religion or meditation. However, they were clearly able to know their own good and to know what was even better when it was pointed out to them. They were psychologically sound, able to look after themselves, capable. A person who is truly capable can turn their capability in almost any direction. You can go out to work or choose not to. You might know how to do a bit of gardening. You might know how to do a bit of carpentry. You might be able to look after a baby or cook a meal from any leftovers in the kitchen. In fact, confronted with any given situation, difficult or otherwise, you can cope, you can manage, you can get by. You know how to look after yourself, and you can look after others if need be. This is the capable human being, the product of the long march of evolution, and the kind of person one will need to be in order to embark on the path of spiritual development. It doesn't matter whether or not you are interested in religion, philosophy, spirituality, mysticism, high art, or even Buddhism itself. None of this counts for much if you are not, first of all, a capable human being. Someone who is able to be an effective member of society in the ordinary sense, to look after themselves, manage their own life, and make their own way in the world. It should be said that being capable is not always a matter of one's own efforts alone. Some qualities are the result of all sorts of deep-seated conditions that stretch back through your life or that may simply have been inherited. If you have had a supportive upbringing, that is, one in which you have been surrounded by people who care about you, who have helped you grow and learn effectively, the necessary qualities may come to you quite easily, especially if, because of your personality, you have been able to make full use of those opportunities. In all likelihood, you will have the resourcefulness and stability of mind to begin the path of self-directed spiritual practice. Without these advantages, you may find it hard to muster the ordinary human capability to take you forward in the spiritual life. If your upbringing and life experience has been particularly difficult, if there are psychological or emotional factors that stand in the way of spiritual progress, you may need time to overcome these and to integrate the various aspects of your personality into a single-minded clarity of purpose. You may be inspired by the Dharma, but lack the practical human qualities and the mental toughness necessary to make a success of practicing it. If you realize that you are psychologically frail or emotionally dependent, the best thing to do to begin with is to work steadily at that level. Not everybody who comes along to a Buddhist meditation class possesses the self-assurance, self-motivation, and independence of mind which are not only associated with successful human behavior, but which also give the necessary drive to spiritual practice. If you are in this position, you will have to devote your energies first to building up your basic psychological strength. You may benefit from therapy or analysis, but it may be even more helpful to work on your friendships and to learn to do a job competently and reliably. Spiritual teachers have a responsibility not to push their students into a more demanding spiritual practice than they are ready for, or allow their students' enthusiasm to lure them into biting off more than they can chew. Meditation can help to sort out one's problems in this straightforward psychological level, just as by introducing a little peace of mind, while ritual and devotion help to generate more energy and positivity. Retreats can deepen and stabilize one's practice. But even someone who meditates regularly and is definitely getting something from it will not necessarily be capable in the sense of remaining emotionally positive through all the ups and downs of a life dedicated to spiritual practice. Not everyone can form a resolution to act in a certain way and stick to it, for example. Becoming a healthy, capable human being takes time. I myself know people who have been meditating regularly for many years, but who do not seem to have got very far spiritually. In some cases, work and friendship are more effective ways of building up self-confidence and an ability to engage effectively with the world. The sutta makes it quite clear that one has to be capable to begin with. Being capable is nothing extraordinary. It doesn't mean being perfect or infallible. It means being adequate, competent, able to make a reasonable success of your work. As such, it may seem a small thing, but being capable may not be something you can achieve immediately. If you do come to see that you are not yet capable in this way, this need not stop you from further spiritual endeavour. There are plenty of other qualities that may be more accessible, and the sutta goes on to tell us what they are. Upright. If you habitually mask your true feelings out of fear of confronting people with the truth of yourself as you really are, you are hardly likely to be able to confront that truth yourself. As well as being able, the one skilled in his good needs to be upright. The Pali word is uju, a term which does not specifically refer to ethics, but is more commonly associated with archery, being used to refer to the shaft of an arrow. It means quite simply straight. Just as the shaft of an arrow needs to be straight if it is to hit its target, the followers of the Dharma need to be straight in order to maintain their true aim. This quality of being upright or straight typically shows itself in our dealings with other people. It concerns the social sphere, the sphere of economic relations, and daily work. In a sense, it follows on naturally from the first quality, being capable. There is a certain clean practicality in the attitude of one who is straight. If you are capable, you will do things in a straightforward, open, uncomplicated way. You don't need to resort to anything underhand or devious. You don't need to duck your responsibilities. You know what you think, and you are honest in communicating it, without playing games or hiding behind half-truths. You are upright. Being straightforward is often the key ingredient in Buddhist practice. It is so easy to compromise, to equivocate, to fudge the truth and dilute your intention. On the whole, I'm pretty honest, you might say. So there surely can't be any harm in softening the harsh reality a bit, covering up the raw truth, bending the bare facts a little just to help things along. It is true that equivocation can sometimes appear to prevent upset, at least in the short term, and avoid hurting people's feelings, even if your own feelings are the ones you are most concerned to protect. There is also no doubt that being straightforward can land you in trouble, and in business dealings it can create complications. Even from a worldly point of view, however, these difficulties will in most cases be offset in the longer term by a positive dividend of trust and respect from colleagues and clients. From a spiritual point of view, we have to consider what the avoidance of confronting people or situations is really about. If you are watering down the truth of what is really going on, you are watering down your ability to apply the Dharma to your life. If you habitually mask your true feelings out of fear of confronting people with the truth of yourself as you really are, you are hardly likely to be able to confront that truth yourself. You need to be able to see the real danger in being woolly and vague, to see that avoiding the truth of the immediate situation fatally undermines your practice of the Dharma. Being upright in this context involves being clear about your aims and honest about how they are to be achieved. The upright and straightforward person knows his or her own mind and is not afraid to speak it. Freedom from fear and anxiety is a natural consequence of this willingness to be honest. If you are genuinely straightforward, you will not attempt to conceal whatever negative emotions might arise. Even if you are prone to anger or lust or fear, you can acknowledge these tendencies and so avoid the guilt and alienation that goes with dissimulation and pretense. You will be emotionally engaged, self-confident, and uninhibited. The sutta is itself unequivocal and uncompromising in advocating this virtue. He should be able, upright, perfectly upright. The only way to be straight, the sutta seems to be saying, is to be perfectly straight. Straight without any qualification or rationalization. Suju, perfectly and happily upright. Let there be no doubt about it. It may seem from this that being straightforward is a very straightforward virtue. However, one needs quite a degree of psychological integration if one is to have the kind of emotionally positive, trusting nature that can deal with others without the feeling the need to dither or to beat about the bush. On the other hand, you may think you have no problem with being straightforward when in fact your plain speaking is close to boorishness. There is a difference between being open and candid and being simply blunt and crude. Harshness of speech can masquerade as honesty and openness when it really expresses a closed attitude towards others, a lack of awareness of the effect upon them of one's speech and manner. Some people pride themselves on being outspoken. I speak as I find. When really, it's just an excuse for being insensitive to other people's feelings. A straight approach can turn into a bludgeon if it goes with a lack of awareness of the complex differences in people's sensitivities and an assumption that the consequences of your straight talking are not your affair. So, a further human quality that the sutta recommends to one who wishes to attain the state of peace is that of gracious speech. Speech that is good, appropriate and pleasant. We cannot afford to be abrupt or uncaring in our communication with others if we want to make progress towards that ultimate goal. Flexible. Buddhism calls not for cringing self-abnegation, but for heroic altruism. A quality that offsets the unhelpful connotations of straightforwardness or perfect uprightness in speech is kaasa, a word that seems to have caused translators a few problems. Kaasa can be translated as obedient. But it is not exactly docility or submissiveness. It is more an amenability, a willingness to go along with other people's ideas as long as they are not actually unreasonable or misguided. Amenability counteracts the obstinacy that tends to go with a straightforward attitude. Being amenable doesn't mean that you immediately allow others to have their own way against your better judgment. But you won't set your face against their suggestions just because those ideas were not originally your own. You are reasonable in debate and easygoing, especially in matters of no great importance. And you will be prepared to follow the lead of someone more experienced or better qualified than you are. The dictionary translation of the next adjective in this line, mudu, is soft, mild, weak and tender. Clearly, we can rule out weak in the present context. We are left with a sweet temper, a mild and gentle manner, a tender responsiveness. It is a quality that emerges naturally out of the previous one. Mudu suggests a pliancy, a suppleness of mind, without any sense of being weak or easily led. There is plenty of elasticity, plenty of give in your attitude. Where flexibility is required, you can be flexible. You can adjust. You are adaptable and even-tempered. Finally, there is anatimani. It is translated here as humble, a word which carries some rather unfortunate connotations. Someone who is skilled in their good is not going to adopt the obsequious, hand-wringing posture of one of Charles Dickens's more repellent characters, Uriah Heep, who repeatedly declares himself to be ever so humble. Buddhism calls not for cringing self-abnegation, but for heroic altruism. Mana means mind, and anatti, not high or not extreme. So, anatimani means an absence of high and mightiness, arrogance or conceit. It does not preclude a proper pride or self-respect. We now have a composite picture of one skilled in his good. Such a person is capable, completely straightforward, gracious in their speech, amenable, flexible, and lacking any conceit. What is perhaps most significant about this initial impression of someone who is proficient in the means of attaining the state of peace is that if you were to meet such a person, they would not necessarily strike you as religious, certainly not pious or holy. They are simply positive human qualities. The sutta seems to be saying that the practice of Buddhism consists, first and foremost, in the conscious development of the ordinary virtues of the happy human being. Contented, easily supported, with few duties, of light livelihood, with senses calmed, discreet, not impudent, not greedily attached to families. Contented. One's contentment, or lack of it, is basically always with oneself. Santusako, or contentment, the first mentioned quality of the second verse, presupposes a degree of individuality. Firstly, the contented person knows how to find satisfaction with what they have. Of course, only a Buddha or Bodhisattva or Arhant would be content in absolutely any situation, but in most circumstances, a contented person will have an inner peace, a brightness or warmth or harmony within. This tends to obviate the need for stimulation from outside. The person who is contented is thus one who leads a simple life. Conversely, one who leads a simple life will become contented. Contentment is linked to individuality, in that if you are an individual, you don't need anything special to compensate for some lack within yourself. You have a being of your own. You are not unreasonably dependent on external circumstances or on the approval of others. you find a certain sufficiency or fulfillment within yourself, in the experience of your own being. It is in this sense that you are contented. But in trying to be self-sufficient and choosing not to expose yourself too much in the way of stimulation or excitement, aren't you shutting yourself off from others and closing your mind to life in general? In fact, contentment is the opposite of a closed or fixed state of mind. It is a state of openness and freedom. Contentment is a generous state of being wherein you have no need to cling to anything or gain anything in order to be happy. When you are content, you have a healthy enjoyment of your state of being, free from caginess or undue reserve. Depending on your inner resources does not mean cutting yourself off from other people. That would suggest not so much contentment as complacency. As the near enemy of contentment, complacency betokens a superficial satisfaction with things as they are, particularly with yourself. If you scratch the surface of this self-satisfaction, you are likely to find blind attachment to your present state at almost any cost. You inwardly, and perhaps not so inwardly, congratulate yourself on being the way you are, with no thought of ever becoming anything different, anything more. You regard your present state as final. You do not look beyond it, and underneath, you are clinging to it for dear life. Complacency is related to a fault referred to more directly in the first verse of the sutta, atimani, or arrogance. The arrogant person, like the complacent person, does not want to go too deeply into anything that might threaten their fixed idea of who they are. Yet, ironically, complacency and arrogance stem from a lack of contentment with who they really are. Your apparent contentment is with who you think you are. You know, or you feel, that the real you is simply inadequate. Perhaps you are unwilling even to get to know the real you and to explore your real identity for fear of the shortcomings and inadequacies you may find. So, instead, you climb on your high horse and create a false self in place of the real self. If you do that, you fend off any real communication, because true commation. Start the paragraph again. If you do that, you fend off any real communication, because true communication always involves opening yourself to others. An arrogant or complacent person would rather not know the truth about themselves, which in turn means that they cannot really be receptive to others. Only by learning to feel metta for themselves and others can such a person move on from their fixed and therefore false view of themselves. Stillness, simplicity, and contentment can be said to be the positive counterpart of the third precept, abstention from sexual misconduct. Without contentment, for example, a married person will perhaps experience dissatisfaction with their situation and start looking around for a new sexual partner. But when you are emotionally more self-sufficient, that is to say, more contented, you are aware that a sexual relationship cannot bring complete fulfillment, but only a certain level of satisfaction. You will then be more likely to be able to keep to the terms of the marriage contract, not looking outside it for some special experience that seems to promise greater fulfillment. You realize that contentment is found in what you are and what you have, not in what you could be and what you might have. Our desire for the things we crave seldom bears any relation to the capacity of those things to satisfy that craving. People usually eat sweets not because of their flavour, but for the temporary experience of reassurance they give. But reassurance is intangible, and certainly not to be found in a plastic wrapper, so we are more or less certain to be disappointed. Then, having failed to assuage our craving for reassurance, and in the absence of any more creative option, we are likely just to eat another sweet. It is as if we suffer from some constant niggling need, some nameless lack, some ever-present void that we try to fill with something, anything, a sweet, a special treat, a flick through the pages of a magazine or the television channels. This is the repetitive nature of neurotic craving. We cannot enjoy what seems to be the things we desire because what we really want is insubstantial. Although we see it in the object, it is not really there. The sweet, after all, does not contain reassurance. It only contains sugar. Reassurance is a subjective experience, and one can only find it by looking inwards. One's contentment or lack of it is basically always with oneself. All our attempts to get satisfaction from external objects, or the hankering and scheming and yearning, come from this restlessness, this refusal to accept ourselves and our condition. If we are to become contented, therefore, we will need to be a radical shift or direction in our search for satisfaction. Trying to arrange the world to suit our desires will never produce the stillness and simplicity that characterize true contentment, but only the irritation and disappointment that come from dependence upon external conditions. Contentment can come only from our inner resources, from creating the appropriate conditions within our own mind. We are dissatisfied with our experience, but we look in the wrong place for the solution. We look out into the world for the remedy, in the form of desired objects and people, when we really need to be looking inwards, into the hidden treasure of the mind itself. To be contented, then, you need to have a positive appreciation of yourself. This is why the Metta-Bhavana meditation practice begins with the cultivation of metta towards oneself. So you need to have a certain degree of contentment to practice the Metta-Bhavana. But then the practice itself will strengthen that sense of contentment. We can begin to see that the practice of the Metta-Bhavana meditation can be an example of what is sometimes known in the Buddhist tradition as the path of irregular steps. According to the sutta, we need to have all these human qualities if we are to be able to feel and express metta fully and effectively. But we will be greatly assisted in the development of qualities like contentment by our attempts to develop loving-kindness towards ourselves and others. Easily supported. We need productive activity for our physical and psychological well-being. In the first verse, the sutta sets out the qualities of the healthy human, one who is able to take responsibility for making their own way in the world. The second verse brings a transition, suggesting a more specifically mendicant lifestyle. The term subharo, easy to support, refers to the economic situation of the monk. The suggestion seems to be that we renounce work and commit ourselves to a life of contemplation, relying on the support of others to give us the necessities of life.
The quality we have just been discussing, contentment, clearly also supports this. If they are not contented within themselves, the monk and nun will not be able to sustain their chosen lifestyles. The fact is that in the Buddha's time, the monks were completely dependent upon the lay people, who provided them with food, clothing, and even sometimes with shelter. With the basic necessities of life taken care of, the monks and nuns were free to devote their energies to meditation, study, and devotional practice. This being the case, it was the responsibility of the monks to be easy to support, and not to make life difficult for those who were considerate enough to provide them with their material needs. The tradition of the homeless wanderer being supported by society at large was not instituted by the Buddha. He inherited it. It existed in Indian society already. In the Buddha's day, the renunciation of social identity was a common and accepted practice all over northern India. And the homeless wanderer, or Pribhakajaka, was thus an accepted outsider. When the Buddha started out on his journey to enlightenment, he too left the home life to become a Pribhakajaka. After the enlightenment, many of his disciples came from that same casteless social category, or rather non-category, and continued to go on foot from village to village with their alms bowls, accepting whatever food they were given. In the early days of the Buddhist community, the Sangha, the priority was to establish spiritual community on principles that transcended the worldly concerns of the wider society. As the figure of the itinerant spiritual practitioner was already a feature of Indian society, and the support of such individuals by the wider community an accepted tradition, the Buddhist Sangha adopted this mode quite naturally.
The withdrawal of the monk or nun from the world of work went with an attitude to work, particularly manual labour, which still persists in Indian society today. The view that it is inherently unspiritual. The ancient Indians had a similar view to that of the ancient Greeks, except that, whereas the Athenian state relied on a class of slaves to carry out any manual labour that might be necessary, Indian society depended on a number of lower castes. The Greeks have, of course, given up slavery, but to a large extent, India continues to run on the basis that physical work is inherently degrading, and that no respectable person would do such work if he or she could possibly avoid it. Thus, in the India of the Buddha's day, the possibility of taking up the spiritual life and continuing to do physical work simply did not arise. You could not be a full-time spiritual practitioner and continue to support yourself. But by virtue of the same attitude, you could rely on the lay people to support you. Indeed, the religious renunciant was almost compelled to depend for alms on the lay community if he was to form any kind of socially acceptable relationship with them. Nor did the Buddha think it worth challenging this convention. It is not, after all, such a bad thing in principle for the more spiritually committed to be supported by the less committed. He accepted the customary division between monks or wanderers and lay communities as a reasonable way to make this happen, and a way of propagating the Dharma in the process. But as Buddhism developed and spread, the range of activities that the full-timers were able to take up expanded. In the beginning, They were expected to devote all their energies to meditation, study and teaching. For the first 500 years, the teaching was passed on entirely through oral transmission, so a good deal of the time would have been spent learning the suttas by heart and chanting them continually to impress the doctrine on the memory of every monk. Then, when the suttas began to be written down, a great deal of literary activity ensued. Later still, with the building of the great monasteries, monks would have been involved in the sculpting and gilding of images, as well as in the design and decoration of the monasteries and temples themselves. Later, when Buddhism, especially in its Mahayana form, travelled to China and Tibet, whose cultures had a more practical inclination than that of India, monks began to take up everyday physical tasks. Tibet, for example, has no cultural prejudice against manual labour, and in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery, you will find monks energetically engaged in all manner of necessary activities according to their various abilities. In the Qian and Zen schools, work is considered to be an integral part of a fully committed spiritual training. As in Tibetan monasteries, monks are expected to throw themselves wholeheartedly into every task that needs to be done, from cooking, cleaning, chopping wood and drawing water, to the printing of Buddhist texts. So we have to be careful not to be trapped by our respect for ancient texts, such as the Karanaya Metta Sutta, into thinking of practical, physical, or even economic activity as being necessarily worldly or unspiritual. A human being is not only mind, but also has a body inhabiting a sensory, physical universe. We need productive activity for our physical and psychological well-being. If our mind is the only part of us that gets any real exercise, whether through study or teaching, or at an office desk or computer, there will be an imbalance in our being as a whole, and we will need physical work and exercise to bring it back into balance. I know from my own contact with Buddhist monks in Southeast Asia, admittedly as far back as the 1950s, that they can get into quite an unhealthy state. Not just physically or psychologically, but also spiritually, from lack of exercise. Their dependence upon the laity, who in most cases looked after them extremely well, was such that even though the monks would have liked to have done more for themselves, the lay people would not let them. As I remember it, the lay people felt embarrassed or even affronted if the monks tried to do things for themselves. It is, after all, through service to the monks that lay people traditionally express their devotion to the ideal of enlightenment. On the face of it, the dependence of the full-time spiritual practitioners on the laity ought to contribute to the simplicity of their lifestyle, enabling them to concentrate more of their energy on purely spiritual matters. But in reality, it can hinder them from engaging their energies at all. Perhaps in the early days of Buddhism, this unequal distribution of labour between monks and laity was necessary. The dawn-to-dusk burden of physical labour was no doubt so heavy that a degree of freedom from such duties was essential if one was to have the time and energy for reflection and other higher pursuits. It is understandable that a conflict emerged between the demands of farm and field on the one hand and those of spiritual pursuits on the other. And an outright separation of the two was probably the most straightforward solution. However, the cost was a certain alienation.
from worldly affairs on the part of the monks, and from any real spiritual life on the part of the laity. It would seem then that this concept of subharo, easy to support, owes its appearance here to the social conventions prevalent in India at the time of the Buddha. In view of this, it would be a mistake to interpret the term as suggesting that someone committed to leading the spiritual life must be materially supported by others and should not get involved in practical or economic activity. In the market economies of the modern world, we are very fortunate in being able to be full-time Buddhists while at the same time involving ourselves unashamedly in straightforward, practical tasks. We should take that opportunity. In our practice of the Dharma, there is invariably a healthy tension between the need to be involved in the sphere of worldly human activity and thus practice the other regarding aspect of the Dharma, and the need to withdraw from worldly activity for the purposes of meditation and reflection. As modern Buddhists, we have a unique opportunity to decide for ourselves how this balance may be struck in our lives. In doing so, we need to return to the basic principles of Buddhism, and specifically to the principle of right livelihood, that is, ethical work. To practice right livelihood, we may have to question our overall attitude to work. Like ancient cultures, industrialized societies have their own conventional attitudes to work, these attitudes being based, in the case of the latter, on the strict division between paid work and leisure. For many of us, work is an activity we don't want to do but have to do in order to support ourselves, and leisure time is our own time, in which we are free to pursue our personal interests. This unhappy distinction seems to affect much that we do. Jobs, tasks, physical activities with some practical purpose or end in view, like cleaning or cooking, are considered a burden, a chore, and resented as such. And we imagine that when we are not working, we should be continually diverted. We certainly don't want to have to do chores. However, all human beings, even spiritual full-timers, need work, in the sense of some productive, useful activity, whether paid or unpaid, that is beneficial to themselves and to others. And simple, practical, physical work may be better than intellectual work from the point of view of fulfilling this human and spiritual need. If you are able to devote all your time and energy to meditation, study, teaching and writing, all well and good. But not everyone is able to meditate or study the Dharma day in, day out. Many people, including many monks, are quite unsuited to teaching or writing. So for them, an injunction to refrain from working and physical activity would be quite unhelpful. Of course, this means that we have to be able to carry out such work without resentment, without considering it demeaning or a burdensome imposition. Today, we have the opportunity to reappraise the whole question of work and financial support. We do not necessarily have to accept the traditions as they have come down to us, especially when these are influenced by Indian social and cultural conditions of some 2,500 years ago. In modern post-traditional societies, you can renounce family life and worldly occupation without having to rely for your livelihood on those who have chosen to engage with them. You can choose to work with other Buddhists, that is, others who share your aspirations, in such a way as to support one's spiritual development and at the same time provide for the material needs of each of you. The necessity to support oneself financially can become an opportunity to deepen communication, share skills, and learn new ways of cooperation and mutual support. Working in such a situation, you can take full account of individual temperaments and attitudes to allow each person to work in a way that is appropriate to their spiritual needs. Some people might find it suits them best to do mainly manual work, while others would benefit from gradually taking on more managerial responsibility. Of course, everyone would need time for meditation and Dharma study. In today's world, it is up to the individual to choose their own way, to make their own decisions, according to whatever principles they wish to live by. There can no longer be blanket rules for spiritual life and practice. What is appropriate at one time and in one place may not work in another. We need a new kind of Buddhist culture in which economic relations can be constantly recreated to meet a constantly changing world. This is probably as close to the Mahayana ideal of the Pure Land, the perfect environment for spiritual practice, as we can hope for. Next section, give what you can, take what you need. There are very few people who would benefit spiritually from being entirely supported by others in the way that the traditional monastic Sangha was. Taking the sutta at face value, therefore, we can interpret the term suparo, easy to support, as referring to how a monk should behave in terms of his economically dependent role with respect to the laity. But there is a deeper and less historically specific principle at work in this part of the sutta. Whether we are monk or lay, or neither one nor the other, we are supported by society at large and dependent on the labour of innumerable other people for the necessities of life. We do not grow all our own food or draw our own water. We do not build and furnish our own houses or weave and sew all our own clothes. If we reflect on how it is that we can enjoy so many consumer products for so little outlay, if we think of the hours of cheap labour that go into what we are able to buy for next to nothing, we will find that we are not at all easily supported. There are also environmental and ecological considerations to take into account. The natural and human resources available to our society should not be expended heedlessly or needlessly. The fact that we have the financial resources to help ourselves to what we fancy does not justify our consuming the wealth of the world without consideration for the claims of others, both in the present and in the future, on those same resources. We owe it to the society that supports us to give what we can to support others. There are very few people who would benefit spiritually from being entirely supported by others in the way the traditional monastic Sangha was. The principle behind this term, suparo, therefore comes down to taking from the world and from society no more than you need and freely contributing whatever you can. You are entitled to rely on others for the help and support that one human being can reasonably be expected to give another, but you also need to be prepared to stand on your own two feet as far as you can. You cannot expect to be propped up by others as a right. This principle operates on all levels of exchange, not only on the material and economic level. We need the emotional support of others, for example, but we should not expect from our friends
what we are capable of providing for ourselves with a little effort. Once they have helped us back on our feet, we shouldn't expect them to prop us up indefinitely. If you are emotionally needy, you are clearly not yet capable, and as such, you are not easy to support. You are therefore unlikely to make much progress in meditation. Of course, if you are such a person, it is quite possible that you will not understand that you are making undue emotional demands on others, and that their time and energy might be spent better in other ways. In that case, it is up to your friends to help you to see the truth of your situation, and perhaps direct you towards getting some therapeutic help, rather than offering support that will just perpetuate the problem. Next section, simplifying. Work can be an unhealthy means by which to escape from being alone with oneself and one's feelings. If you are aiming to be easy to support, the way to do it is to keep your wants and needs to a manageable level in whatever way you can. This is the ideal to which the term Salahu Kavuti refers. A livelihood, vuti, that is lahuka, meaning trifling or lightweight. It suggests a basic simplicity to one's attitude to life, a determination not to be weighed down by a multiplicity of wants and desires or onerous material commitments. Clearly, a taste for hard work and a relish for the challenge of practical tasks and problems to be overcome is a virtue, but it is possible to like these things too much for one's own good, especially if they become distractions from the more spiritually pressing challenges. So the sutta goes on to say that one should be apakito, with little work or with few duties. The fact is that one can become too busy, even with religious or spiritual activities. Again, with reference to the monastic context of early Buddhism, the sutta warns against giving yourself too many things to do. The monk shouldn't be too occupied with performing ceremonies for the laity or running errands for his teachers or preceptors, or even with teaching his own pupils. He should allow himself enough time for study, meditation, reflection, and just spending time quietly by himself. All the things that lay people in fact support him to do. Work, in the sense of pleasurable, productive activity, is a necessary part of life for most people. But there is a difference between this and a kind of neurotic, compulsive activity that masquerades as work, but is really a way of keeping the deeper emotions at bay. Work can be an unhealthy means by which to escape from being alone with oneself and one's feelings. We should beware of feeling that we just have to keep busy, that we can never be without something to do. So, yes, by all means work, but don't let busyness be an escape from your true self. Be occupied only with those activities that are really necessary. Next section, modest. We should avoid getting our feet under the table in the course of our involvement with groups, systems, and ideologies. The division of labour between monk and lay person has other disadvantages. Relying completely on other people for your support puts you in a passive relationship with regard to them. There is a suggestion of this danger in the sutta, in which the Buddha now enjoins the monk to be apagabo kusala anutgito. Like Subaru, the term apagabo clearly has to do with the relationship between wandering monks and the lay people upon whom they depend. It is the negative form of pagabo, which means impudent, overbold, tending to push oneself forward. And Saditissa translates it quite neatly as modesty. Together with the term that follows, kulesu anugito, greedy after gifts, it would seem to refer to the danger of monks insinuating themselves into special relationships with particular families. It could happen that a family would end up adopting a particular monk in a way of domesticating him. To avoid this, the sutta directs the monk to avoid making strong connections with anyone or soliciting special favours from them when on his alms round, as this is against the whole spirit of renunciation for which he stands. Reading between the lines of the sutta, we can see that even the homeless wanderer of the Buddha's day was not necessarily free from attachment to the things that came his way, few as these must have been. He might well be tempted to secure creature comforts and a certain sense of belonging by getting to know certain families out of a yearning for the approval and acceptance of ordinary people. To guard against this, he is counselled to cultivate a sense of identity based on inner stability and contentment. But how should we ourselves interpret this exhortation? After all, we don't knock on doors for alms. For us, perhaps, the danger is of depending for our sense of identity upon the acceptance or approbation of others, being afraid of exclusion. The possible result of such dependence is that one is unable to make decisions, hold opinions, dress, eat, or do all manner of other things without reference to the norms of the group whose approval one seeks. To protect ourselves from this, we should avoid making ourselves too much at home in any one human grouping, or identifying with a group too rigidly. We should avoid getting our feet under the table in the course of our involvement with groups, systems, and ideologies. If you are skilled in your good and wish to attain nirvana, you cannot afford to be too attached to the approval of any group, whether it is your biological family, your cultural or ethnic group, your caste or nationality. A mature individual has an existence, as it were, in his or her own right, without needing to have recourse to the affirmation of any group, be it a family, a community, or even a religious movement. Such a person is capable of finding a sense of fulfillment within the experience of his or her own being, independent of external circumstances. Next section, the sixth sense. When you are free from greedy or anxious grasping at objects, you are free to enjoy them fully. The clarity of purpose discussed thus far finds expression in a particular kind of mindfulness suggested by the term santidriyo. This is translated as with senses controlled or with senses disciplined, as though the senses were like wild horses to be reined in and brought under control. But this is not an accurate reflection of the nature of the bodily senses or an accurate translation of the Pali word. The literal meaning of santi is not disciplined but calmed, and it is not to the wild horses of the eyes and ears that it refers, but to the wild horse within, the wild horse of the mind. It is traditional in Buddhism to speak not of five senses, but of six.
not just the senses of sight, sound, taste, smell, and touch, but also that of the mind. And of all six senses, it is the mind that is the origin of craving and attachment. It is only as a mental experience that we need to address the issue of sensual experience at all. The physical senses are in themselves quite pure. Their nature is just to register stimuli. They are being stimulated all the time we are awake, as all kinds of phenomena impinge upon them and present themselves to our consciousness. In fact, the physical senses are not so much wild horses as windows or mirrors. They may be obstructed or closed or stained, but they do not determine what degree or quality of light passes through them or is reflected by them. They are themselves incapable of mischief. There is nothing inherently wrong with seeing forms and colours, nothing wrong with hearing sound or tasting food. If our minds were pure, if they were in the seen only the seen, in the heard only the heard, to quote another famous Pali Sutta, there would be nothing to pacify, no conflict to resolve. If, for instance, you were able to look at a flower, you might experience an intense perception of colour, scent, perhaps movement, and you might simply appreciate that sensory experience. If you didn't appropriate what you saw or smelled, if you didn't react to it with craving, no unskillful mental state would have arisen from that sense contact. Likewise, with a disagreeable or fearful object, if you could respond creatively to the experience, without reacting to it with revulsion or horror, no unskillful mental state would arise. Ideally, this is what we need to be cultivating, the ability to appreciate any sort of sense experience simply for what it is, free from the imposition upon it of our likes and dislikes. Appreciation is very much part of this activity of mindful awareness. Even though we cannot rely on sense experience for lasting fulfillment, it is nonetheless to be enjoyed on its own level. You need food that is wholesome and nutritious, for example. If it tastes good as well, so much the better. If someone offers you some succulent fruit, for instance, you will appreciate it as both nourishing and delicious. On the other hand, if there is no fruit today but only porridge, that's perfectly fine too. You remain content because your good humour is not dependent on having that fruit. This is how the peaceful mind operates in relation to sense experience. It was once seriously suggested to me that high spiritual attainment made all food taste the same. The person who suggested this, clearly he had quite a high opinion of his own level of attainment, claimed that he no longer tasted rice or potatoes or tea, but simply food and drink in a general sense. This is, of course, nonsense. When you are free from greedy or anxious grasping at objects, you can become aware of them in all their colour, depth and vitality as never before. You are free to enjoy them fully. The more aware you become, the more sensitive you are to subtle differences of taste, sound and so on. This is the middle way between hedonism and hair-shirt asceticism. You don't have to avoid good food, but if your ability to remain happy is too dependent on what you are given to eat, then some degree of renunciation is clearly in order. To be aware of what is pleasant is fine. It is when we move on to forming a desire for that pleasant experience to stay as it is, and therefore the desire to possess it, that we sow the seed of future dissatisfaction. Likewise,
unpleasant sensory experience need not inevitably produce dissatisfaction. It is the mind reacting with ignorance, craving, or revulsion that produces the sense of dissatisfaction. All the objects of the senses, things, people, experience, are impermanent, always changing. And when the mind is calm, you are able to simply let them be as they are, without the anxious desire to grasp at them or to push them away. Having said that, we do need to limit the sense experience to which we expose ourselves. The movement from the bare perception of something into the desire to possess it or move away from it is taking place all the time, but at such a subtle level that we need a certain degree of mental stillness to be aware of it. By exercising choice over our sensory experience, we aim to calm the mind, withdrawing, in a relative sense, from worldly activity as a way of simplifying and deepening awareness. There are 1,001 sensory distractions ready to impinge on our awareness in everyday life, and any one of them can quickly engage our interest in an unguarded moment. Modern forms of publicity and mass communication are expert at seizing the attention and manipulating the emotions so as to induce states of greed, craving, and aversion. They make use of the fact that there are certain ideas, images, sounds, and even smells that will affect most people's minds in a particular way. Popular forms of entertainment, for example, rely on violent or erotic images to hold our attention and keep the mind excited and spellbound. For the average person, at least, it is thus not advisable to give free rein to sensory stimuli. The best time to visit the supermarket or pastry shop is when you are not feeling hungry, and therefore more likely to be drawn into a greedy state of mind by the cleverly arranged displays of tempting titbits on offer. Our aim, however, is not to shut down perception, blinker the senses, or rigidly control input. Isolating ourselves from experience in this way would produce a brittle, artificial contentment that could not withstand the knocks of ordinary life. When calming the mind's response to the world through the senses, you can still act, think, make decisions, and engage with people and with things, but you don't allow your choice of actions to reflect a neurotic and rigid adherence to personal likes and dislikes. Training the mind may well involve restraining the eye from contact with certain visual objects, and the ear from taking note of certain sounds. But with practice, your contentment will not be dependent on your living simply. It is fundamentally the mind that has to be pacified, so that it becomes more aware of its own movements. Once your mind has become calmed, and your awareness broadens and deepens, you become more sensitive than before to your experience. A sensitiveness that begins to shine through with great vitality and warmth.
Discreet. The practical wisdom called for here is simply the ability to keep out of trouble, spiritually speaking. The ability to find contentment in one's own resources depends on one having a certain degree of psychological integration in the sense of self-knowledge. You have to get to know the conditions, both internal and external, that tend to produce discontent, and learn how to bring to the fore the inner qualities and resources that support contentment. In other words, you have to be what Sadista translates as discreet and Chalmers as quick-witted. The Pali term nipako suggests intelligence in the sense of prudence, the ability to adapt means to ends. It is a practical kind of wisdom. There is also a sense of being able to forestall trouble. The prudent person knows what is likely to result from certain kinds of actions within a given situation. As we have noted, it is the mind that has to be calmed, not the senses. Nonetheless, external conditions are still important. When we make decisions and choices about the kind of environment in which we allow our senses to operate, we need to exercise nipako. We owe it to ourselves to look for circumstances that will inspire and support our cultivation of higher states of consciousness. To settle for less when we can do something to change our circumstances is a kind of false contentment that is more like lethargy. Most of these will be circumstances that everybody will find helpful, so it should be a relatively simple matter to find out what they are. Where discretion becomes particularly necessary is in judging where you as an individual should draw the line in any situation. Rather than falling back on a set of inflexible rules about what you should or should not do, you need to exercise your own judgment based on what you know about yourself. Whereas one person might find that a certain situation quickly brings about an unskillful mental state, another person might find they can handle the same situation quite skillfully. In all likelihood, a bodhisattva or arhant could encounter crude images and noisy environments and still sustain mental states that were just as skillful as those they would have when looking at beautiful and peaceful scenery. But for the rest of us, the guarding of the senses is a crucial aspect of the practice of mindfulness. Thus, one's practice of ethics involves observing for oneself what one's reactions are likely to be. The mark of a morally responsible individual consists in knowing the kind of environment he or she really needs and trying to bring it about. This is especially true if you are living or working with other people. It is part of your responsibility towards others to take care of yourself, to make sure that you can bring enough contentment into the situation. If you aren't able to be positive, you aren't really pulling your weight, spiritually speaking, and somebody else is going to have to make up for that. Your mental state will impinge on others unless someone else takes up the slack. If you put yourself in a situation in which you are bound to feel discontented, you are being irresponsible with regard to your own welfare and letting others down as well. Doing something about this is easier said than done. Somehow, you need to cultivate contentment even while you are trying to turn an unsatisfactory situation around. For ordinary human beings, with all their quirks and inconsistencies, their habits, their likes and dislikes, their longing for approval, comfort, sympathy and all the rest, this is no small thing to ask. In any situation that does not place us under extreme or prolonged pressure, contentment is certainly an achievable goal. But the ability to maintain contentment and inner harmony in absolutely any situation is one of the defining characteristics of a Buddha, Arhant, or Bodhisattva. Whilst it is a goal to aim for, it should not be an expectation placed on a practicing Buddhist as a matter of course. Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, contented as they may be in themselves, will not be content as far as others are concerned. They will see whether situation and circumstances of others can be improved or transformed and will do something about it. They will recognize how unskillful states of mind and unskillful actions are brought about by certain conditions, and out of compassion will draw attention to that fact and try to remedy the situation. Such is the contentment and practical wisdom of a bodhisattva. Of course, this is a far cry from the ordinary human contentment required as one of the preliminary qualities for the development of metta. This more achievable form of contentment is simply a relative freedom from the inner dissatisfaction that compels us to seek pleasure and fulfillment in external things. Likewise, the practical wisdom called for here is no transcendental quality, but simply the ability just to keep out of trouble, spiritually speaking. The key characteristic of one who is self-aware is that they are able, indeed find it necessary, to act in accordance with their aspirations and make their own judgments rather than comply with the norms and requirements of any group. If you are an individual, you are able to take responsibility for yourself, for what you do, and for what you think. However, you still need to form relationships with other people. In fact, taking responsibility for your own decisions and experience will make you more truly responsive to the needs of others. Being independent, you are better able to relate to others than if you were to rely on external affirmation and approval for your sense of well-being. That is, you are more able to be ethical. Morality, understood in the Buddhist sense, is not so much about rules as about personal growth and progress, both your own and that of those around you. In the spiritual community, the group and its norms are ideally replaced by the subtle relationship of Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship based on that which is wise, skillful, morally beautiful, and true. The spiritual community has as its goal the highest possible development of each of its members, as well as that of the spiritual community itself as a whole. Indeed, it aspires to contribute, at least indirectly, to the ultimate welfare of all beings. Beyond certain broad categories, it is impossible to reduce morality in this sense to a matter of observing rules, of doing some things and not doing other things. Relying on the strict application of rules and regulations seems to work satisfactorily only in the case of simple, straightforward situations. Most circumstances are so complex, and human beings themselves so various, that what is a skillful and beneficial course of action for one person may not help another person, or even that same person at another time. What is right in one set of circumstances might not be right in other circumstances. And what is right for one person might not be right for somebody else. This is not to suggest a complete ethical relativism. The point is that given the complexity of real-life situations, it is difficult to judge exactly how even carefully agreed moral principles will work out in practice, or whether what you are doing is really good for you or for others. Once you begin to sharpen your ethical awareness, situations that had formerly seemed entirely straightforward may begin to raise knotty moral problems. If you cannot rely on the rules and, as is often the case, you cannot fall back on a reliable intuitive sense of the skillful thing to do, what is left for you to rely on? The traditional answer is that in this kind of situation it is the opinion of the vinu, literally those who know, that is your best guide. In other words, you can place your faith in the informed judgment of those in the spiritual community with more spiritual experience than you. Hence, the next verse of the Karaniya Metta Sutta. He should not pursue the slightest thing for which other wise men might censure him. The wise, where do we find them? So the person who is skilled in his good and wishes to attain the state of calm, who has the very positive qualities set out in the first two verses of the sutta, should not do even the slightest thing with which those members of the spiritual community who are wise might have cause to find fault. This is a necessary and important criterion for ensuring that your actions are taking you on the right path. To know that those who understand how unethical actions are followed by consequences will not censure you. But how do you know that they really are wise and that you are not just seeking the approval of the more powerful and influential members of the group? This is a question that is not always easy to answer. In extreme cases, it may be easy to see the difference between conformity to group values and reliance upon the advice of the spiritual community. But obviously, there will be intermediate cases where you might not be so sure. Situations may arise in which you are uncertain whether you are acting on the advice of the wise, because you want to be accepted by the group and fear rejection, or because you respect the greater spiritual maturity of those you are consulting. Either way, their opinion will matter to you. But a reliance on the opinion of the wise, in the sense that the term has it in the sutta, is really a question of how far you regard your spiritual friends as being a truly spiritual community rather than just another social group. The wise have to be those in whom you have real confidence, those whom know you have, again, the wise have to be those in whom you have real confidence, those whom you know have your best interests at heart. But such trust can come only from experience, in other words, from giving them some provisional trust. You may have taken their advice on trust in the past and found from experience that in some circumstances their judgment is more reliable than your own. You may also know and trust other people who have found them trustworthy. However, you garner this testimony of experience. It takes time to discover whether or not the members of what you have identified, again provisionally, as the spiritual community, have a degree of vision, skill, and maturity that you yourself do not yet possess. If we are going to be sceptical about those who appear to be the wise, we have also to be sceptical about our own objectivity. Perhaps it should not come as too much of a surprise to discover that we are inclined to doubt the judgment of the wise. They have, by definition, a different perspective than our own. The fact that they really do know and we do not means that we cannot see things quite as they see them, because we lack their vision and their level of understanding. In order to be receptive to the advice or censure of the wise, you therefore have to have a personal relationship with them. Only by knowing your spiritual friends well can you be sure that they know you well also and have your best interests at heart. Indeed, may understand your best interests better than you do yourself. You can then accept their judgment even when it does not correspond to your own. A spiritual friend is someone who knows you well and cares about you. They won't see your welfare in quite the same way as you do. They will see beyond what you want for yourself, almost as a parent sees that the welfare of their child does not necessarily lie in what the child wants. But the spiritual friend will be, at the same time, disinterested. They won't be upset if you don't do what they suggest. They don't have an emotional axe to grind. Next section. Spiritual friends, our moral touchstone. With metta, you can always see through that greed or stupidity to the beauty of the human being. It is through metta that you can hold the two together, the ugly truth and the beautiful reality. In the spiritual community, the rigid application of rules is replaced by something far more subtle. A living network of friendship and communication centered on the highest shared ideals. Essentially, friendship within the spiritual community is based on metta, on an appreciation of the other person's virtues and faults alike. Feeling metta does not blind you to the facts. If someone is greedy or stupid, you see that they are. But with metta, you can always see through that greed or stupidity to the beauty of the human being. It is through metta that you can hold the two together, the ugly truth and the beautiful reality. Indeed, if you don't see the one, you won't really see the other, not clearly anyway. So feeling metta does not mean seeing the inner beauty of people while deliberately blinding yourself to their weaknesses and imperfections. Nor is it about appreciating their weaknesses, or even appreciating them in spite of their weaknesses. It is more subtle than that. It is more like an aesthetic appreciation or the clear-sighted love of a parent for their child. You see the child's faults and weaknesses and the qualities he or she needs to develop, but your knowledge of these frailties has no effect on your love. Indeed, it is in the nature of real love to nurture the loved person without cherishing any illusions about them. The wise have an ethical sensibility that is the product of their own experience and transcends the legalistic application of rules. They don't look at your actions in isolation, but in the context of your emerging individuality. It is like the aesthetic sensibility of someone who really understands painting or literature. They know quite intuitively what painting or literature is. Someone who knows what writing is can start reading something and know after a few paragraphs whether it's worth continuing or not. A person, too, is all of a piece. Of course, the difference between a book and a person is that it is always worth continuing with the person. Also, when our spiritual friends become aware of certain of our actions, they may not know all the circumstances, but they will have an accurate sense of whether those actions are skillful or not. For our own part, as the sutta says, we would do well to give the spiritually mature the respect they deserve and heed their opinion. That opinion will not necessarily come in the form of censure. It's generally more subtle than that. You may detect some change in them, or they may detect some change in you. Either way, you begin to be conscious of some disharmony between you. Not in a dramatic or obvious way, but more a sense that you are no longer on the same wavelength, no longer really communicating. It may well be that your spiritual friends are oblivious to any change in the relationship with you. They may have said nothing to you. Nonetheless, you may start to get the uncomfortable feeling that they are displeased with you, even angry or reproachful, and you may begin to feel resentment and even anger towards them, even though they have no idea what is going on. Surprisingly, perhaps, this sort of misapprehension is one of the most useful products of spiritual friendship, for it shows that your ethical sense, your sense of shame, is developing. You know in your heart that you have started to go astray, to slide a bit, and this is your way of allowing your guilty conscience to make its presence felt. In time, if they are at all mindful of their relationship with you, your spiritual friends will begin to notice that something is amiss, that you seem rather uneasy, perhaps a little sullen or unforthcoming. When they probe gently and kindly for an explanation of your changed demeanour, you may start wondering how this has happened, and how you can re-establish communication and harmony and put your friendship back on track. Once they are able to say that they are not angry with you and that you have done nothing to displease them, you can take the opportunity to say that, well, actually, you do have something on your conscience, if only they knew. Clearing the air with your friends in this way, you come back into harmony with the spiritual community. All through your openness to the possibility that your spiritual friends, those who really know you, might disapprove of what you're doing, even, as the sutta says, on account of the slightest thing. The essential element is your own sensitivity to the ethical sensibility of others, not your fear of punishment or disfavour. If you feel your spiritual friends are beginning to disapprove of you, that they are not quite at ease with the way you are, the chances are that you should take special care. It is not your spiritual friends who have changed and started to drift out of contact. It is you. Outside the spiritual community, people are not as rule committed to this expansive aspiration to grow and to see others grow. Without spiritual friendship and metta, what masquerades as helpful criticism may be no more than a thinly veiled form of one-upmanship. If the effect of your helpful criticism is to leave someone feeling downcast, it is not an expression of metta. Outside the spiritual community, and sometimes despite our best efforts within it, the emotional basis for interpersonal communication is so fraught with competitiveness, not to say aggression, that even a well-intended criticism can hurt and be wide of the mark. In the context of general spiritual friendship, however, I would go so far as to say that if you were to point out to someone that they had acted unskillfully, even if this were painful for them to hear, they would feel better for your having told them. Perhaps these difficult situations in which openness and honesty are likely to involve a certain amount of pain are the real test of metta and of depth of our friendship. If your straight talking expresses a sense of moral superiority, however justified, and a wish to put someone down or make them feel small, you are clearly not motivated by metta. But as long as your communication is infused by a genuine feeling of metta, your friend will feel not crushed but liberated by what you have said, and the friendship will become stronger as a result. How you stand in relation to your spiritual friends is a very good touchstone of where you stand ethically. Whether or not your friends are happy with how you are progressing tells you whether or not you need to be concerned about your spiritual practice. However, it must be emphasized that the censor of the wise is not an authority to be followed blindly. Whatever you do must be your own clear choice, for which you take full responsibility. Group censure is essentially a demand on the part of the group elders that you conform to the standards and norms of the group. By contrast, in the spiritual community, the criticism that you receive comes ideally from a different kind of attitude. Though, of course, even within the spiritual community, censure and advice is sometimes offered and received in the spirit of the group.